So I am a grateful believer in Jesus. I struggle with control and anger and recognizing my worth. And I'm celebrating victory over anxiety and perfectionism and addiction. And my name is Marcella. I was born in a small town in northern Minnesota, the eldest of three children. It was a tranquil place and idyllic in many ways. However, we had our share of issues as well. The overriding issue in my family is addiction. My grandfathers, my uncle, my parents, if you shake our family tree, quite a few drunks are going to fall out. But my father quit drinking when I was 5 years old, and my mother quickly followed my dad into sobriety. Consequently, I grew up in a recovery-focused home. We attended church regularly and were generally a happy, close family. Things went along quite well for a few years, and then life served up a curveball. In the mid-1980s, the iron ore mines that sustained the families in our town began to fail, and my father was one of many who were laid off. The company would call the laid-off workers back to work for a few months and then lay them off again, and this went on for years. My parents went through their entire life savings. They were losing our home to the bank, and we prepared to move. As we walked through the empty house for the last time, I found my mother sitting at the kitchen table crying. It was the first time I had ever seen her cry, and I suddenly realized something was very wrong. For the first time, I was not sure everything would be okay. We moved into an apartment over my grandparents' garage. I was aware that we were very poor. I look back now, and I'm amazed at their strength, self-control, and the commitment they had to making sure our life was as normal as possible. They even sent me to summer camp. It was affiliated with our church, and I imagine the church sponsored me to attend. We called it Bible camp, and I can still picture the little chapel we sat in each night, and it was there at 9 years old that I accepted Jesus as my Savior. Funny place to kind of joke up, but it was a good moment. After going through several cycles of layoffs and callbacks, one of the company supervisors who went to our church informed my dad that he wasn't on the callback list this time. My parents decided that they would move away from our hometown to seek employment. My father, a journeyman electrician, headed down to the city and had a job in 3 days. My family prepared to move again. We arrived in our new town when I was in the sixth grade. I was outgoing, made friends easily, and didn't really mind being the new kid. Life went along pretty well for us for the next few years, and then a major shift occurred. The year I started the ninth grade, my sister started drinking. She was 13 years old. Always painfully shy, and with our family history of addiction, she jumped into drinking with both feet, and from that point, the dynamics of our family were changed forever. I can only describe it as her drinking and alcoholic behavior sucked all the air out of our house. I remember thinking I could hardly breathe. It was so chaotic and unpredictable. Her rebellious behavior took all my parents' attention. She sneaked out at night, and when she stayed in, she sneaked friends and boys into her room. She regularly attended parties in the most unsavory neighborhoods in the city and would get left behind by her friends because when they were ready to leave, in her words, the party wasn't over yet. The chaos and destructive outbursts that were the norm when she was home were replaced by stress and anxiety about what the night would bring while she was out. Many nights, my parents picked her up from the police station. It was difficult being in a family with an active alcoholic. While perhaps not quite as destabilizing as having an alcoholic parent, having an addicted sibling set up power struggles and a constant vying for the attention from my parents. I was already a classic oldest child overachiever, and given the dynamics of my home life, I tried even harder to gain recognition at school through extracurricular activities. I took on as many leadership roles as I possibly could. I was a cheerleader, and I went after becoming the cheer captain with zeal. However, no matter how much success I had at school, when I returned home, I was met with criticism from my mother and a sort of benign, disconnected aloofness from my father. And there was always the constant undercurrent of heart-pounding uncertainty about what insanity would start up as soon as my sister arrived home. There are two major themes that run through this period of time for me. The first is that I was constantly trying to get my father's approval. I had indeed become the cheer captain, and during the final season of my senior year, I started asking, demanding really, that my dad come to one of the games to see me perform. I thought that if he just came to see how accomplished I was, how hard I had worked, that he would be proud of me. I longed to be daddy's girl like some of the other girls on my squad whose proud parents sat in the stands beaming and cheering along with us. My mother spoke for him. He's tired at the end of the day. He works so hard. He doesn't like sports. It was in answer to that last one that I finally snapped one morning. I stood near the front door in the morning before school and shouted, "But does he like me? Can't he just come to see me?" I lost my temper. I continued to shout that that night was the last game of the last year, the last season I would ever be a cheerleader, and if he never came to see me, that I would never forgive him. I shouted and slammed the door as I stormed out of the house. And that night at the game, I kept my eyes on the door, waiting and waiting. As we prepared to go out on the ice after the second period, my heart sank. He wasn't coming. After we left the ice and had taken our seats on the bench, I felt a tap on my shoulder. It was my father. He had come 10 minutes too late. It was over. He had missed every game of my entire high school career, my high school years. I was crushed. My heart was broken. It was the first in a string of broken-hearted disappointments that would haunt me for most of my adulthood. It was that event that crystallized the belief that I developed about myself. I am not worthy of approval, especially from the man closest to me. The second theme was that my ever-vigilant mother focused all of her energy into making sure that my sister made it through high school alive. That was her actual stated goal. Well, of course, I supported this goal. Nonetheless, I resented my sister for sucking all the time, energy, and attention from our mother. I was doggedly pursuing my goal of getting into a good college and was receiving no support from home. I wanted to go visit schools, but my mom would say that she could not leave my sister for the weekend. Having been encouraged all my life to shoot for the stars, be anything I wanted to be, and go for it, I was very confused as to why it seemed I had to do all that dreaming and reaching and achieving all on my own. I heard two messages. On the one hand, dream big and go for it. On the other hand, I heard, "You're too grandiose, too much of a dreamer, not realistic enough." My ideas were criticized. I know that she did this in order to save me the pain of pursuing a goal that wasn't well thought out or well planned, but at the time, it just made me question my ability to make decisions without her approval, a pattern that would continue for many years. I attended church regularly, even after the rest of my family stopped attending. I would drive myself to the youth service on Wednesday nights and feel so grateful for the peaceful, joyful atmosphere. I can remember marveling that as we worshiped together, the energy in the room would shift, and I just knew that God was there. My parents warned me that they wouldn't be able to pay college tuition for me. I heard them, but I didn't really listen. Where there was a will, there is a way, I thought, for a girl accustomed to pressing on and succeeding through my own efforts. The thought of filling out necessary paperwork and getting the proper loan sounded quite doable. I applied for colleges. My parents told me not to be so grandiose. I asked my mom for their tax return, and I filled out financial aid paperwork. My mother suggested community college. My friends were going to Ivy League schools and private women's schools out east. I was not going to community college. At 17, my view of the world was not broad. I had been told that getting a college degree from the best, most prestigious one possible was the path to success, and I believed it. Overachievers like me were not making plans to go to community college. I felt confident I could get into the school of my choice. And one afternoon, the letter arrived. I had gotten in. I was elated. Even though I knew it was a long shot to pay the tuition, I had gotten in. I ran inside with the letter. Proudly, I handed it to my mother. She looked it over and responded, "Well, you might as well just throw that away because you are not going there." The wind left my sails with a whoosh. Again, I was crushed. She wasn't happy that I had achieved my goal. She didn't congratulate me. She was not proud of me. Her reaction, and with all the attention going to my sister, with all her destructive, chaotic behavior, I decided a few more things about myself and how life works. There is no payoff for being the good kid, I told myself. Anger and chaos are much more powerful than peacefulness. And not only am I not worthy of approval, the goals I was setting to win that approval were themselves suspect. Perhaps I could not accurately judge for myself how to win at life. And so I began to change my goals. I applied to a small college in the University of Wisconsin system. They didn't really offer the major I wanted, but my friend was going there. When I was in a car accident just days after graduating high school, I could not work through the summer, and I had to withdraw from my last choice college. I had pushed, cajoled, powered through, pressed on, manipulated, and done everything I could to realize my dream of going to college. And in the end, I landed at the local community college with the stoners from Auto Shop. I was devastated. I really had no plan B. I thought that my life was destined to be on the fast track to nowhere. My big dreams had gone down the drain. I sank into a very deep depression. I felt incapable of making my life turn out. I decided that hard work and perseverance were not enough if you didn't have someone in your corner to help you along. Life circumstances were unpredictable and more powerful than I was, and nothing I could do would help. It was this belief led to an almost constant feeling of victimhood. Even after all those years in church, it didn't occur to me that God was on my side or by my side. In my pain, I turned away from church altogether. I felt I was destined to be a loser, maybe mediocre at best. I was not worthy of anyone taking time for. One day toward the end of summer, after a violent fight with my sister, I decided to move out of my parents' house. I was 19 years old. And I began at this point to do two things. I began waiting for a champion to save me and show me that I am worthy, and I began to self-destruct and turn all that pain inward. I began smoking cigarettes and pot and drinking and partying and working full-time. Little by little, quite on my own, I picked myself up, numbed the pain, and started moving on. I stuffed the pieces of my broken heart and spirit back inside, lit up a cigarette, took a toke off the bong, put on some makeup, and went dancing. When I was 21, I met a man. I perceived his bravado as inner strength, his cocky swagger as confidence. He was charming. I ignored the rumors about his abusive past. 6 months later, he had given me herpes, multiple bruises from the night he decided to show me what respect was with his fists, and a badly shaken sense of personal safety. It was my first experience with physical abuse. I moved safely back in with my parents. I cut off all ties with him. I chain smoked for 3 days straight. I felt like the rug had been pulled out from under me. Again. Aha! But this time, I knew what to do. Smoke a cigarette, take a toke off the bong, put on some makeup, and go dancing. Get numb. Wait for a champion to save me. I moved through my 20s in fits and starts. I would encounter a good opportunity and then slowly sabotage it. How else could I live out the self-fulfilling prophecy of unworthiness? I was irresponsible. I got fired more than once. I moved every 6 months. I partied 5 or 6 nights a week. I ran up credit card debt. I had turned my back utterly on God. I had no idea he could help me. Why would he? The thought didn't even cross my mind. In my mid-20s, I fell in love. It was a powerful, deeply passionate, volatile relationship. It opened my eyes, however, to the transformative power of love. I think it was God's first step that registered with me anyway, toward bringing me back. I was seeking something spiritually. I just didn't think I could possibly find it in church. Luckily for me, God does not constrain himself to working only within the walls of a church. He found me where I was, in a bar, dancing. And he gifted me with this love, and I knew that something deeper existed in the world. Something that could reach through the smoke screen I lived behind and save me. But the path back to God's arms was going to be long. At age 24, I was introduced to a series of seminars that helped me heal many of the issues that were plaguing me. As I got some issues cleared up, I began to make some choices that were better for me. Less partying, not none, but less. My whole family had participated in those seminars, and it helped us to heal old wounds. My sister got sober as well. We were always a pretty close family, but now we were connecting in a deeper way as adults. I got a call one day offering me a job at a church working in the nursery on Sundays. It was to be a pivotal experience in my life. I fell in love with those children. I loved that little job better than the sales, marketing, and office work I had been pursuing. I enrolled in a technical college to get a certification for early childhood development. See how God slipped that church connection in there and coupled it with what would be my career working with children? Man, he's good. However, as much as I worked and healed and life was looking good, I was still suffering on the inside. I only endeavored to do things that I knew would be a slam dunk. I played it safe. Consequently, I did not take much pride in my accomplishments. I just played not to lose all the time. So from that place of relative safety, I began doing pretty well. I began working with children. It was during this time that I met the man who would become my husband. We fell in love. There was a peacefulness in this relationship that I had never experienced before. And we had so much fun. We married the year I was 28. I still wasn't interested in church or God, so we had a lovely ceremony in a beautiful outdoor setting. However, a personal friend who was a minister married us. God wasn't going to let me get married without him. And so the passage from Corinthians about love was read at my wedding. But I was slightly irritated. I really was still in the dark. I wanted children, and 3 years after marrying my dear love, God saw fit to bless us with a daughter. We were ecstatic. I focused all my energy on being the best mom I could be. I fine-tuned all my old perfectionist ways. I took my life firmly into my own hands and endeavored to do it right. Capital R. I leaned heavily on my mom for advice because despite the criticism I felt in high school, she became my closest confidant in adulthood. We had healed together in my 20s, and we really were best friends in my 30s. So my mom had my back with parenting advice. I read book after book to continue my learning about infants. My house was spotless. I improved more and more as a cook. And I began to consider myself a success in this tightly controlled world that I had created. Then in 2006, my husband encountered a career opportunity here in Portland. I felt strongly that I should say yes to moving. I felt peaceful about it, and it was an easy decision. And so, in April of 2007, our small family arrived in Westland, Oregon. I began to make new friends and set up a new life here in Oregon. I decided I wanted to quit smoking once and for all and began seeing a Christian therapist. I geared up and did it, and for the first time I was successful. Hooray! I was free! However, she did have a few other questions about how I was handling life. During one session, she frankly asked me, "Marcella, where is your God? Why aren't you in church?" She observed that I seemed about half in the dark. I knew exactly what she meant. There were still some dark, murky, gunky places within me, and she correctly observed that they were taking up about half the space in there. One day, meandering around, I came across the loveliest little church. It's seated right next to a pond with a little footbridge and ducks swimming. In my opinion, God uses beauty to get our attention. And that idyllic little setting sure got mine that day. "Abundant Life Family Church," the sign read. A couple weeks later, I went to the service. I connected right away with the message. I really liked the pastor. The next week, I brought my husband. We started attending regularly. God started to move in our lives. My husband stood up one Sunday and turned his life over to Jesus. And miracles started to happen. A wonderful new job opportunity came up for him. We bought a home, and I opened a home daycare. I got pregnant with our second child, and we were thrilled. The pregnancy went well, and in September of 2008, we had another beautiful daughter. But when at 10 weeks postpartum, I became pregnant again, our world shifted on its axis. Pregnant again? I sobbed and sobbed. I went into the doctor, and we realized I needed an ultrasound to determine the conception date. So off I went to the appointment. While laying on the table, staring at the ceiling, wondering how in the world I would handle this new twist, I got the news that, frankly, still seems shocking 3 years later. "It's twins," announced the tech. I started laughing hysterically, and I do mean hysterically. My husband and I were reeling. We had just been through a year of pregnancy and childbirth. How would we afford a family of this size? We immediately had to buy a bigger vehicle. I cried out to God, "Why? What are you thinking? How will I handle this?" The ladies at church assured me that everything would turn out okay, and so I took a deep breath and I soldiered on. I found out I was pregnant in January, and by May, I had to close my daycare at my neonatologist's firm request. Twin pregnancies carry some different risks, and a much higher incidence of premature birth is one of them. And I did not want that. So we were not sure how to afford our home without my income, so I began looking for apartments. But again, God moved mountains for us. Quite without warning, my husband's business started to pick up, and our financial troubles were eased. That July, tragedy struck my family. My mom was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. It was devastating. I felt I had never needed her more. She was my friend, my confidant, an integral part of my support system. She felt confident that she could and would heal, and so we all felt confident that she would as well. She told me that she intended to hold the new babies, dance at my sister's wedding, to be held a few months later in December, and retire to Florida with my father. In September, the twins were born. At the end of September, my mother came to visit and love up the new babies. In December, she danced at my sister's wedding in Costa Rica. It was the vacation of a lifetime for our family. In mid-February, when she became less and less coherent and I couldn't really converse with her on the phone anymore, I booked a flight back home. A few weeks later, on the first day of spring, my beloved mother left this world. I was devastated, traumatized, completely overcome with grief. Who would I lean on to hash out the intricate details of life? Who would give me advice? I could not believe the size of the hole that her departure had left in my life and in my heart. My heartbreak was really indescribable. I thought the grief would shatter me into a million pieces and that I would never be able to put myself together again. Unable to cope, I leaned on my old addiction to cigarettes to help me get through. After all, I knew well what to do. Light up a cigarette, take a toke. But wait a minute, the game had changed. I had far too much responsibility to get stoned and drunk and go dancing. So I took my children and my cigarettes back to Oregon and attempted to soldier on. I knew that no one would pull me out from underneath the tidal wave of grief and pain that would surely drown me if I let myself experience it. I reached out to God only by hopelessly calling, "Help me." But help me he did. He sent an army of angels to help me. He sent oodles of business deals to my husband. But in my grief and feelings of overwhelm, I just could not see. Quickly, I decided the best way to cope, read that as not cope, was to stuff all the tiny little pieces of my shattered heart and spirit back inside, put a tight-fitting lid on it, light up a cigarette, and just be fine, and wait for a champion to come and save me. Well, you have all heard the acronym for FINE, right? Frustrated, insecure, neurotic, emotionally unavailable. Well, you can probably guess how well being fine worked for me. I was a stay-home mother to three small infants and a six-year-old. I was exhausted, and despite all the angels he sent my way, I felt very alone. I operated all day, every day, in sheer panic-stricken survival mode. But because I love those children so very much, and there is so much joy in parenting, I was unable to fully recognize what was happening just below the surface. By fall, I was so anxiety-ridden and neurotic, I couldn't even make the simplest decisions, and I started having mild anxiety attacks. I was hypermanaging every detail I could get my hands on and striving to attain perfection. I knew something was very wrong with me. When I mentioned to a friend what was really going on with me, she suggested I check out this 12-step program she'd been attending. She said she was feeling a lot better herself since attending and that you could go with whatever issues you had, not just addiction. So I walked my grief-stricken, anxiety-ridden, overwhelmed, cigarette-addicted, broken-down self through the back doors of Celebrate Recovery the very next Wednesday. And I cried, and I cried, and I ached, and I cried through my sharing time in the open share group so many times. And I didn't break. It wasn't long before I realized that God had brought me home. All I had needed all along was to surrender all that pain to him, all the heartbreak and the bitter unworthiness. I cried when I heard what has become my life verses. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Matthew 11:28-30. And so God saved me again, and I suddenly realized that I had my champion. He had been with me all along, a flawless, immensely loving champion who thinks that I am a treasure, who helped me when I couldn't think to ask. And I began to pray. I felt so inadequate for the task he had set before me. 4 children so close together is so hard. And he called my mother home when I felt I needed her most. Every week of that first year in Celebrate Recovery, I prayed, Lord, make me enough. Make me enough for all that is required of me. I took a step study. I connected with other Christian women. And little by little, I surrendered it all to him. It wasn't easy. But to me, that is the value of doing this work in a group. When I floundered, those brave, amazing women were right at my side to support me. They prayed for me as over and over I prayed, Lord, make me enough, make me bigger, expand me, Lord, that I might do this job in excellence. I surrendered my need for perfection, and I experienced God's grace. The anxiety evaporated. I worked the steps. He lifted the built-up grief from me. I cataloged my hurts in my inventory, and the clarity that gave me helped set me free. I made amends. I keep making them. I stumbled. I just kept coming back, kept doing the work. Soon my heart felt lighter. Randomly, people started to mention to me how far they thought I'd come. The peace and the joy in my heart started to show. And finally, after 2.5 years at CR, I was ready for the final showdown with the addiction that had been plaguing me for so many years. With my sponsor, accountability partners, and most importantly, God, firmly supporting me, on January 30th, 2013, I finally quit smoking. Thank you. Thank you. So I have been smoke-free for exactly 4 months tonight, because I knew what night to quit. And so I close with Isaiah 41:10. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. And so he is champion for us all. Thank you.